life is about plan B, right? You may plan, like I plan, I mean, I told you earlier, I plan to be a structural engineer. I think most engineers start as structural engineers for some reason. But then, you know, I did it and I didn't love it. So I pivoted, right? And I like traffic engineering. But then because of the economy and the things like that, I ended up doing planning.
You're listening to the Building Better Futures podcast, where innovation meets inspiration. In each episode, host Eric Hirani journeys alongside notable thought leaders who are shaping the future, cultivating exceptional work cultures, and nurturing the next generation of trailblazers. We aim to spark inspiration by engaging in dialogue with leaders from groundbreaking companies, innovative projects, and exceptional teams. Our goal is to empower individuals to positively impact those around them and leave a lasting legacy of positive change in our communities and society at large. Let's dive in together and explore what it takes to build better futures, one conversation at a time.
Today, I'm joined by Mike Sciama, the New York Metro executive from TY Lind. Hey, Mike, how are you?
Hi, Eric. I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks so much for doing this. I've known you many years, and I'm actually really excited to hear about a lot of your background. Before we get to that, let's start with good news and gratitude. I think for most people that have listened to the show before, they know that's how I like to start. Any personal or professional good news, gratitude, shout out for a teammate you want to share with me in the audience?
Yeah, absolutely. So two good news, I guess. One on the personal level, one on the professional level. Personal level, my brother and his family came back from Syria last night. So I was at the airport at JFK until about 1 a.m. So I got probably about 4 hours of sleep. I'm grateful for those 4 hours. On the professional level, there was something that, you know, we pre-positioned for and prepared and met with the client and to see what they like, what they don't like. And then an RFP came out. We went for it. It's an on-call and we won the on-call. So I'm very happy and grateful for that.
Wins are fun. Wins are the best. We do good news and gratitude every morning as a team. I do a daily huddle with my direct reports. And whenever we win a project, it's always very, very good news. High on the list for good news and gratitude. So that's awesome. And I love to hear about pre-positioning. And, you know, it's obviously a smaller firm looking to grow and become a bigger firm. Those are the things like I talk about with my like pursuits team and my proposal team. And how do we do better about that? So maybe I'll pick your brain with that at some point. But thank you for sharing. Congrats on the win and welcome back to your brother. I'm sure it's nice of you to pick him up. And I'm sure you guys had some drive somewhere. So you spent some time together there, which is probably nice. My good news and gratitude show days. Gratitude is always to the guest. I know you're incredibly busy. So just thank you for doing this and being here. And then I do have a little bit of a personal good news. And, you know, I've been battling this like terrible hip injury for the last probably like 2 months now or month and a half. And I haven't been able to run and I hate running. So that's not a bad thing, except for I do these like short, like super sprint triathlons, a very short distance bike, run, swim. And so I haven't been able to train and I have one coming up this weekend. And today was the first day I was able to, I didn't run, but I was able to walk, jog a 2 mile. So I think I'll be able to complete the race and that's what I'm excited about. And so that's my good news for today. I'm like, I'm really amped up about it because I hate when my body's not 100% physically. It just, I hate it so much. And I spent so much time like trying to
it's
rehab.
It's great to hear that you're recovering. And I made a habit of only running if I'm being chased by something. Yeah.
I hate it. Out of the like biking and swimming, I actually really enjoy. I hate running, but you know, it's a fun activity. It doesn't take, it's short and it's enjoyable. All right, great. Well, with that, let's learn some more about you. Tell me about your background, right? Like, where did you grow up? Where did you go to school? What brought you into this industry? Tell me a little bit about yourself.
Sure, yes. So I grew up in Syria. I grew up right on the Mediterranean in a small city at the time, although it's bigger now, called Tartus. And I always had that bug. I wanted to travel. I wanted to see the world. And when I had the opportunity to come to the United States to study, I came here and then I stayed. And as you say, the rest is history. Why I got into the industry, civil engineering is something that's always been attractive to me. But I do remember actually the last couple of years in high school, I started exploring options. So any professional I could meet, I would just talk to them and ask them like a million questions as a curious kid about what they do. And I don't know, something about being out in construction with the hard hat and the dust and that's something that just like appealed to me. So I just kept coming back to that, even though I explored other options. And no regrets. I love it.
That is very cool. And so when did you come here? Like how old were you? Was it very early on in life? Was it later in life?
No, it was early in life. So I came here, I was 20 years old. I just turned 20. I actually started college in Syria, the University of Damascus. I studied a couple of years and I took a year off. I worked on a ship of all things because I came from a shipping town. So I just wanted to explore that before I committed to something full time. So once I knew I was coming here, I took some time off. I traveled. I worked on a ship for 6 months, just in the Mediterranean, transporting cattle of all things. And I was a helping hand, so I would clean up after the cattle, after they left the ship. And then once I came here, I went to a community college to start because I had to learn English as I was learning engineering. So I actually ended up taking some classes over that I already took in Syria because I wanted to learn English through the technical way. And then from that community college, I transferred to Rensselaer, or RPI as he used to call it back then, and graduated from there with a bachelor's degree. And then 8 years later, I went back while I was working full-time and I got my master's degree.
Do they not call it RPI anymore? I still call it RPI.
I see Rensselaer everywhere on their marketing materials. So I don't know. I say RPI or Rensselaer. People seem to know it either way.
It's a big rebranding, but great school. And what this is the stuff I love. I didn't know that you grew up in Syria. And two, I never knew you worked on a boat. What a unique background. And I love your approach in that whole story about like, I would speak to different professionals about what they do because we don't really like get that here. You know, I mean, most of us will go through school and at some point, junior, maybe senior year, your guidance counselor will say, hey, you're good at science. Maybe you want to be a doctor. Or hey, you're good at literature. Maybe you want to be a teacher or something. And that's really kind of the exposure we get. And
yeah,
I do think it's important to talk to different people about like what different professions actually do, because it's more often than not, the academic version of that profession is not the actual version of that profession. So very cool. So you said you were working full time and going back. And so was that, were you with the DOT at the time or where were you working at that time?
I was at the DOT at the time, yeah. You know, it's funny. I wanted to get my master's degree. Just something that my father wanted me to get a PhD. And I said, I don't want a PhD. I don't want to know so much about just one thing, but no disrespect to PhDs, but I wanted to get my master's degree. So the first attempt was a couple of years out of school. I went for master's of, what was it, MPA. I forget the acronym now. It's like policy and administration, basic public administration. And I did one semester and I did fine, but you know, I had no money. My wife and I had two kids and one car and it was tough. So I stopped. And then a couple of years later, I got the bug again. I went back for an MBA, Masters of Business Administration at SUNY. And again, I did fine in the semester, but it was just so tough with two kids and one car and no money. So I stopped. And a few years later, I was fortunate enough to get a grant. So I applied for the grant and I got $10,000. So I went to RPI to get my master's in engineering, transportation engineering. So I finally did it. Took a while.
I love this perseverance, right? That's like one word, stick to it. That's wow. You were really, I love it. That's like, that's a lot, especially with the growing family. I mean, I have one young daughter and it's already like, I mean, I can see how it takes up all of your time outside of work. Very cool. And so after the DOT, obviously you're now in private sector. And I asked this question, do you know Mike Wallace? He used to be with Port Authority.
I do.
Yeah, yep. Mike's a great guy. We had him on the show a while ago. And one of the questions I asked him, and I'll ask you because I find it so interesting, is like, what did you think that transition from the public sector to private sector would be like? And what was it actually like, right? Like, what were the things you didn't expect that actually ended up happening? And just tell me a little bit about it. What was it like?
Yeah, so most people don't know this about me. And a lot of times, like they say, you're only as good as your last job. So a lot of times people introduce me to other people, say, Mike Sharma from the Thruway Authority, because that was a public job I had, which I only had for 3 years. I spent actually about 24 years at DOT. But before that, I was actually a consultant.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. So that's the one thing that most people don't know. But I actually, when I graduated in 1987, it was December, the economy was pretty bad. And you mentioned guidance counselors and all that. There was no internet, none of that stuff. you literally went to the placement office and they had a book. And I took the book out and I copied all the addresses and everything. And I applied to literally 100 positions, public sector, contractors, consultants. And I got zero offers. The economy was just bad. Like, the people really were not hiring. And I kept those 100 letters for many, many years. I only got rid of them about 5 years ago. I was like, why am I keeping these things?
Wow.
Well, then one of the professors posted something, a couple of different positions in the hallway. So I took the numbers both. I called. There was a job in Cape Cod. So I did a phone interview, small engineering firm, and I actually got offered the job. But then I thought, like, how am I going to move? Like, I have no money to move. I literally had no money. I couldn't move. Luckily, I applied to the other job, which was a little bit south of Albany in East Bern. And a small, again, small engineering surveying firm. And I didn't hear back for a couple of weeks. So now I was getting nervous. So I called the number and the guy, the owner of the company, answered and he said, oh, yeah, I saw your resume and I got rid of it. I was like, what? And I said, may I ask why? And he said, why? If I remember, you're looking for a structural engineering position. That's what I was. And I don't have that. I said, well, what do you have? And he said, well, a little bit of everything. I said, well, I'd still be interested. I went and interviewed and I got offered the job and I didn't have to move. And that's where I started. But the economy was so bad that I just had a sense like, I'm just going to get laid off. It was that engineer, another engineer, and me. And there are two PEs or not. And I could see, like, the work is not coming in. But I did a little bit of traffic engineering, structural engineering, surveying, hydraulics, hydrology. I mean, well, a lot of them. Basically, whatever they gave me to do. So at the time, I was talking to my wife, and I was like, I'm going to get laid off. And she said, well, why don't you go work for the state? And being an immigrant, I had no idea what that was. What is that? You know, so she said, New York State DOT. I was like, no. So I called, and I ended up taking the civil service test. I passed. I got a job offer literally within a freeze. They had a freeze on hiring, but planning had permission to hire one position that was before the freeze. So I was fortunate enough, I ended up working for the state. And as they say, the rest is history. I stayed there for 27 years before I rejoined the private sector.
Very cool. Wow. Yeah. What an interesting story. Again, things I didn't know, right? I didn't know you were a consultant. I just always, and even I knew you had some time at Thruway, but I always associate you with DOT, right? Like, that's the time I know of you. And that's great.
I did see the guy who hired me, the owner, was a very nice guy. I love the guy. And I saw him years later. I said, hey, Lou, would you have laid me off? He said, Mike, I would have had no choice.
Yeah.
I think the gut instinct was right.
In a down economy, it's tough for everybody, yeah. Right? But fortunately, especially in the work we do, public sector, they have a way of, even in down economies, they still have to keep everything running. So it's pretty, sometimes it's a safe industry, which is nice. All right, well, so we went through some of your career history there. I'm always curious about leadership. So I want to ask you about, like, you said that first boss that hired you really loved, but maybe you didn't have a long experience there. It sounds like you had a lot of time at DOT, some time at Thruway, and then I know in the private sector now. Do you have, like, a particular, like, mentor or, like, an experience that influenced how you lead? Because obviously coming from maybe that position of where you were like, hey, I'm worried about being laid off, right? That's a real experience you had. And sometimes those things translate as you grow in your own positioning. So now as, like, a leader, right, as an executive across New York City for T.Y. Lin, is there a person or an experience that kind of influenced how you approach leadership?
Yeah. But before I answer that, one thing I want to say about transitioning from the public to the private sector, I've seen people do it successfully and I've seen people do it unsuccessfully. And I think to me, the key is to understand, like, what you're going to be doing, right? So I always tell people I transition in my mind before I actually transition in reality. So I always knew, like, when I left the public sector, I'll be a consultant again, right? So whenever consultants would come to meet with me, I was fortunate enough, I was the chief engineer at DOT, as the chief engineer at the Thruway. So I met with consultants all the time, right? And I would be just as curious about what they do as you were curious about the program that we had coming out. So I would always ask questions and things like that. So I was kind of knew what it would be like before I transitioned. And I think I was right about what I expected. And I love being in the public sector. I love being in the private sector. So there's really no difference to me in terms of the level of excitement and energy that I bring to it. In terms of mentors, I mean, obviously it always starts at home, right? So my father, I learned hard work from him. We didn't have a lot of money, so he worked three jobs, and I always saw how hard he worked. And then my mother, I just learned kindness, right? She's like the kindest person I knew. I would egg her on to say something bad about somebody, always unsuccessfully. She would never say anything bad. And I was like, it's like a challenge for me, and I was never able to do it. Like when I started at DOT, there was I'll give some names if that's okay. There was a guy named Henry Perborn, and he was an assistant commissioner. And I was a junior engineer. I'd been there less than 6 months. And he met me at one of the meetings, and I saw him on the train. I was coming back from a meeting in New York, and it's like I didn't know he would acknowledge me. He acknowledged me. He bought me a beer. And I thought that was like so down to earth. And you learn from that. It's like, wow, this guy's way up there and I'm here. And he just like chose to sit down next to me and talk to me. And I thought that was great. The other person I worked for was Paul Wells. And Paul was the chief engineer. I was the assistant to the chief engineer. And he gave me so much autonomy and so much trust and so much delegation. I learned so much from his leadership style that it influenced my own leadership style. And then there was Dr. Tom DeCoster, who was the ASHO National Transportation Leadership Institute executive director. He did training courses for DOT, so I took a couple of his training courses. Incredible teacher, and I learned a lot from him and talking to him. And I actually stayed in touch with him for years and years after that, and I definitely consider him a mentor. So this is just some of the few. I try to learn something from everyone I work with, whether it's someone who works under my supervision or someone I work under their supervision. Somebody has something to teach always.
Everyone's got something to add. I like the first story about how personal, and I don't recall his name, but you said he's the assistant commissioner.
Yeah.
And, you know, you see him on a train and they say hello. And as someone that's like also been in that position, right? We were all young engineers at one point, or all of us were, there's no dispute. You know, when someone you don't think will recognize you, or someone that, you know, you would think is so busy or so important, and they see you in a public event, or they take time to just say hello, it goes such a long way. And I think it's like a great show of humility as you get further in your career to like pass that back to the next generation. And I've been, like you, just very fortunate to have a lot of great mentors and people that I learned from. And there were people I could trust that there were no dumb questions, you know, and if I would ask, I would get an answer. And I appreciated that. It was really nice. I'm glad you were able to share a couple of names. And I, you know, if you're still close with them, it sounds like that's really wonderful. So I'm going to shift gears here a little bit, because I like to ask, especially with someone that's worked on so many incredible projects, one of the reasons I like doing this show is my passion for civil engineering is about how it really builds the infrastructure that we all use, right? So we get to work on really cool projects that don't get forgotten about or don't live in a spreadsheet. They live in reality. Like, I touch them, I feel them, I see them, I use them. What about you? What's the most, like, personally, like, what was the most rewarding job you were part of or project? What was the most exciting project you were part of?
Yeah, no, Eric, there are so many, but I'll give you just two. I'll do three. So one of them, we had a job to replace a viaduct in the city of Utica. But the way engineers did projects back in the 50s and 60s, it was all about the infrastructure and less about the people who use the infrastructure, right? We severed connections. We killed downtowns. I mean, the stories are endless, right? And I viewed that as an opportunity to reestablish some of the connections, some of the infrastructure connections that were important for businesses, important for the people who live there. And I used that as that project as a catalyst. So for me, it was less about replacing the viaduct itself and more about reconnecting the community, so to speak, right? I mean, we weren't calling it that then, but to me, that's what it was. There is another one that I worked on recently as a consultant, and we working with the Port Authority on the bus terminal and trying to figure out the layout of the new bus terminal, what that would look like. And it's not like an engineer can design it, but how would it function? I mean, it's a very unique facility with hundreds of buses coming into it every day. Where, you know, how would you structure the ramps coming out of the tunnel, interacting with city streets and things like that? And we work collaboratively with very smart engineers from the Port Authority and other consultants. And we were able to come up with something that's actually going to be built. And the first of the many projects are out there already. And that's gratifying to see, because that's kind of a once-in-a-lifetime type of project. And I was glad to be a small part of it to influence the outcome. And the last one, I would say, I was at the Thruway. So I gave you DOT consultant, I'll give you Thruway. The two worst rated bridges on the Thruway system were in the Seneca Nation territory. So the very last 4 miles of the Thruway are go through Seneca Nation. And the relationship's no secret between the state of New York and the Senecas and that bridge, right? So the Senecas basically were saying, nope, you're not going to, those bridges needed to be replaced. FHWA said, you better replace those bridges. I mean, they were almost becoming unsafe. And the Senecas like, no, we're not, you know, those are your bridges. And I was able to meet with the Seneca president and the Seneca Nation Council. And I convinced them that it was the right thing to do. And it's basically bridges over the Thruway. So in essence, the people who use them were the Seneca people, not the people who were using the Thruway. But I used some really smart engineers and architects to do some renderings, and I built some Seneca important elements into the design. We have seven spirit animals, their color is purple. I made sure I incorporated all those elements in the design. And I made it more about them than about us, about the Thruway. It was really more for the people who use it, the people who live next to it, the safety of the people who are going to traverse on that bridge. And I got approval, and the bridges are built and replaced. So that's something I'm very proud of.
This episode is brought to you by Infinite Consulting Corp., your go-to firm for MBE certified project and construction management consulting. Discover how Infinite can help you build a better future at infiniteconsultingcorp.com.
I do have comments about the first two projects, but on that one, I want to talk a little bit. How did you get that information about the Senate? You just did research, or did you already know that? Or
I did research. And again, it's like when you're trying to get something done, you can go, if you go talk to an elected official and tell them what's important to you and why it has to be done, they're going to say, get out of here, right? You have to show them that there is benefit to them as well. And you have to be genuine about it. So I did the research. I found out a lot about the Senecas and how they do things. And when I went to meet with them, I was genuine. I was sincere. I was respectful of their time because they have their own way of wanting to handle issues. And I started their transportation leader, and then I went to the president and then the council. And I mean, they made it very clear. They don't like me personally. They don't like the state. But they understood the benefit of the project for them, and they gave their approval, which is what I wanted anyway, because it was the right thing to do. So they, yeah, the research and the respect and being genuine about it.
It's such a good, I mean, just like even life lesson, right? I mean, it's important to take into consideration what, you know, in that case, like not client, but, you know, collaborator, right? You needed them on the project. It needs to get done. Very nice. That's a great story. I do want to go back to the first project you shared about like creating community and opening up the connection. And like one of the things that as like engineers, architects, people in this industry, we can do, and you're right. And I'm sure if you've never seen the movie, I think it's called Motherless Brooklyn. And there's parts of it that are based on Robert Moses. And it's just like, it's a great movie. But, you know, I know you're talking about dividing community. And obviously, a lot of that happened during that time. But to bringing it back, I really loved what I've seen in the last like couple of decades now, where we're really being more conscious about that. And you're seeing it, you know, I just recently got my wedge certification. So even on like the wedge part of the waterfront is like access to the waterfront, right? Where historically, you would have just blocked it off, you know, you would have built and that would have been it. And we're seeing a lot of it with transit, like transit-oriented hubs, right? We're building communities now. It's not just the planning, like in the master planning is really, really viewing, I was taking that into part of their vision. And so I think it's a really great point. And the other place we're seeing it a lot is even on the private side with a lot of residential towers. Now the what used to be, hey, let's get as many units as we can into the structure, right? Is now, okay, well, where are we going to create community space? Where are we going to create co-working space? My sister just moved into a place in Long Island City, and they have like all of these rooftop areas where they can go out and just hang out, you know, and they have like an arcade room and they have a game room and they've got like all of these amenities, and it's all around building community, right? Like, how do we get people to come together and bring that joy of life. So I think it's really, it was just a great point. I wanted to talk about it because I really love it too. I love our ability to improve the communities we work in. Thanks for sharing those. I'm going to pivot once again, because we're talking about like your career, and now we've gone through some of your favorite projects. And so not when you switch from the private to public, back to private, but you also had an interesting journey inside of that shift back to the private sector, where you went through an M&A, right? And I wanted to see if you could share that with us. It's like, I don't want to say it's unique to the industry because I know it's happening a lot, but I think it's a unique experience. I don't think that many people, because you were president of the firm, right, during the acquisition? Yeah. So you were in a very high level position. You probably got exposed to things. And I'm just curious how, like, what was that experience? And that's got to be a tough decision, right? Do we sell? Don't we sell? Where are we best leveraged and things like that? So talk me through that a little bit.
Yeah. So, you know, within that realm, my experience with that is a little bit unique because I didn't sell the company. The company was sold when I got there. Actually, that's the reason that I got there.
So, oh, I didn't even know that. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. So Sam Schwartz created this company, right?
Right.
Engineering company. And at some point, I mean, everyone has to transition the company and different individuals have different ways to do it. Sam wanted to sell to a small company, not a giant engineering company. I won't name any, but he had many offers and he even had investors saying, we'll give you money, grow the company, do something bigger. But he wanted to kind of preserve the culture and the integrity and all that. So it's a small company. I mean, when I got there, it was about 150 people, maybe 140, somewhere in that range. So at some point in 2015, he made a deal with a company from Spain named GBO. And he started buying shares over 6 years with the understanding at the end of the 6 years, Sam will step down as president and CEO, and then you will own the company. The full company and employees owned about 10%. So they'll do 19 employees who left then. So he was looking for a successor to lead the company when he steps down. And he was very smart to start doing it early. So, you know, Eric Arsamont, our friend.
Yeah.
And I've known Eric through the industry for a long time. So one day he said, let's have lunch. And I didn't know at the time that Sam asked him to help him find a successor. And he had a list of people. And I guess somehow Eric put me on that list. And we had lunch, and I didn't know I was being interviewed by Eric. He's like, wow, you'd be great for that. Because he was asking me questions like you learning about my background. It's like, great for what? So he's like, oh, yeah, Sam is looking. Would you mind talking to him? So, I talked to Sam, and at the time, I was working at another company, and I was fine. I wasn't really looking for something. But basically, he wanted someone to come in, be the general manager of the New York office. If you do a good job for a year, then you move on to becoming president. If you do a good job as president for a year and a half, then you become president and CEO. And then Sam steps away. Well, I didn't know at the time that the company was also in 2017, GPO sold itself to T.Y. Lin. That's owned by even a bigger company called DAR, and now it's called Sidara. So when I got there, the company was already sold. And I found that in short order. And Sam and I talked for about 6 months. Eventually, I said, yeah, let's do it. And by sheer coincidence, Sam and I ended up working on the congestion pricing panel for the MTA. So it's called Sustainable Funding Stream for the MTA. So he was appointed by the governor. I was appointed by the Senate. And I was working again at another firm. We got to know each other very well. I saw how he's in action. He saw how I was in action. We had elected officials on the panel. We had MTA leadership. So it was pretty complex picture, and he liked how I behaved. I liked his style. And after that panel ended in December, I said, let's do it. So I started there in February. Anyway, at some point, the parent company, DAR, decided to merge some of the brands. And I was fortunate enough, again, to be in the leadership. So to me, it was, you know, you're going from basically a small 150, 160 person company to be in part now a bigger company, not a giant company, because T.Y. Lin is not a giant company. We're less than 5,000. So it's a good sized company, but not giant. And I wanted to learn more about T.Y. Lin just for my own benefit. And I found out that it was really a good cultural fit. And it was also the services that we have and the services that they have were complementary. They were not in competition. So no one was going to lose their job because of it, right? People always get nervous about that. I don't need two of this. I don't need two of that. So my job then was to make sure that I worked with the leadership of D.Y. Lin and all the staff and the leadership of Sam Schwartz. And that was a journey that took about a couple of years to make sure everyone felt comfortable. And I'm happy to say, I mean, I lost a couple of people that just decided it wasn't the thing for them. But the leadership of Sam Schwartz is intact, is now fully integrated in D.Y. Lin. And really being part of D.Y. Lin gave us a bigger platform to sell our services that we used to sell at Sam Schwartz. And then the benefit to D.Y. Lin is we're the tip of the spear at Sam Schwartz because we do a lot of the planning effort, and also we give them a service that they didn't have. So I'd say it's been a success story. People embraced it, and I think it's working great. And for me, I knew I would have to take on a different role. So I'm still part of the leadership, working with the CEO and the leadership of Lin to make sure we grow, continue to grow, and continue to serve our clients in the way that they are accustomed to.
Very cool story. So, and I don't know if you know this about me or not, but I'm very like interested in the M&A world. And so I've been to like a couple of conferences and I met with a number of people. And I always like to ask if I know someone that's been through it, I always like to ask that kind of question. And it's funny how often the same things come back up. And it's really like, and you hit on both of them. One was culture, right? You could buy the best company in the world, but if it doesn't fit your culture, it's going to be a problem. And then the other part of it was like complementary, right? So like, are they complementary to you? Is it really adding value? So you talked about being the tip of the spear and like kind of being out front with the planning and stuff like that. And so I'm glad to hear that's a success story. And I appreciate you just giving us a couple of minutes there of the background.
The other thing I like about it, and no disrespect to companies that are publicly traded or companies that are owned by private equity funds. This is neither one of those things. So we're privately held by engineers and architects and planners. So it's not like an ESOP, but it's definitely privately held, employee owned. Like I have some shares in the company.
Oh, wow, great.
So I have interest in its success, and our leadership does. And it was a good fit for me. It was a good fit for the staff, and it's working great.
That's awesome. So in this day and age, AI comes up no matter what. So I want to ask you, as someone that's always been like kind of, you know, future looking, right? How will like AI, automation, smart technologies change like, you know, how we move, right, as a society, right? Like we all talk about ChatGPT, and sure, I can go in there, make it write something for me. But how is it going to change transportation?
I don't think anyone understands that yet. It's something I actually think about a lot, but like every day you just have different thoughts. And I mean, the concept has been around for a very long time, self-driving cars and things like that. We just now actually have the technology to do it. And you can see some of these Waymo or Teslas or whatever, self-driving themselves. But I mean, the way I look at it is, how will that serve humanity, right? And I'm hoping it would enable people to have more access to jobs or more access to opportunities through this automation of services. So for instance, like bus schedule, let's say you live in an area where the bus routing is not that great, right? Maybe there's a small shuttle that shows up at a certain hour of the day or night, picks up people and drives them to employment opportunity or some other thing like that. So I'm just hoping that we focus, not that we don't want to focus on the technology, because you still have to improve it, make it safe, because it's still operating in the same public space as pedestrians and other things. But I just hope that we think about how we can fill in those gaps that exist in our transit system or in our ability to get people to opportunities that they need to get to. So that's kind of how I look at it. And I think it's going to make a huge difference. Like if you're, say you're a senior citizen, you live out in a rural area and maybe you can't get to a barber. Maybe the barber comes to you in one of those vehicles that goes around and maybe picks up a bunch of people, takes them to doctor's appointments. So I think about services like that, and I hope to see that in the future.
That is, without a doubt, your mom's kindness coming. That was like the kindest answer I could ever think of for that. And you really made me like, I feel kind of bad. Like, yeah, you're right. When I think of it, I think of like self-driving cars and flying vehicles, right? Like, but I mean, the way you could really touch like a person by giving them a means of transportation that's more convenient to their job, right? I mean, I live not too far from a very big like Amazon distribution center. And no matter what time of day it is, I'll see people walking. And I can tell that they're about to walk like two miles, some of them 2.5 miles, because they've got their Amazon vest on. And I know where they are now. And I know where that facility is, right? So, I mean, and there's no, and you just like, I mean, you touched my heart there. Like, I feel for those people. Like if they're doing that out of necessity and not out of choice, I hope it's out of choice. But yeah, I mean, just what a kind answer. And I really do hope that that's where this goes. I hope they find ways to connect people. Sorry, go ahead. What were you going to say?
No, it's funny. Like you always think of someone, right? When you kind of think of a technology. So my first wife's grandmother lived in a rural area. It was like services were very tough to come by. And as she got older, she passed now, but when she got older, like she could only go places if her friend stopped by, picked her up and took her somewhere. So I was kind of thinking of that, right? And it's like that vehicle becomes your friend. It picks you up, takes you to where you need to go, or brings something to you that you need. So that's where that came from.
Very cool. I will just quick thing, because you said Waymo earlier, and the CMA conference was in San Francisco last year, and we took one, and I mean, it was wild. Like, I mean, it's kind of crazy. It literally drives you around, and all the mechanical parts of the car are still there, so the wheel is actually turning. I mean, the technology is very cool. Have you been in one? I mean, I
have not. I've seen them, but
like, yeah, they're cool.
Going by, but I've not been inside one.
All right, I'm going to have one more question before we get into our lightning round. And two big reasons I try to do this show is, one, I want to talk about the incredible projects and how we impact the communities we work in like positively. And the next part is to encourage like that next generation of engineers. And so this question is really geared towards that. And my question to you would be, what advice would you give to students today who potentially want to be the next Mike Sciama, right? Like, well, what's some advice you wish you had in school? And you were obviously very, again, forward thinking, right? You were talking to people about their careers and you had a whole, you know, but what's some advice you'd like to share with the students of today?
Yeah, first, I mean, be curious, and you're not going to have all the answers right up front. A lot of times people come to me, young people, and say, I want to do like civil engineering. And I say, well, which part of it, right? And then then sometimes they're not even aware of the different parts of, I mean, civil engineering is a broad term, right? And actually recently, maybe 3 weeks ago, I had lunch with a student and he's looking at engineering, but he was curious, my background in the public sector, and he was asking me a lot about it. And once we got done talking, he seemed very excited about being part of the public sector. So there's public sector, there's contractors, there's consultants, there's non-for-profit. I mean, there's many options within engineering. There are many options. So I just say, be curious about like the different things. Ask a lot of questions. Ask practitioners. And be open-minded. Like sometimes life is about plan B, right? You may plan. Like I told you earlier, I plan to be a structural engineer. I think most engineers start as structural engineers for some reason. But then, you know, I did it and I didn't love it. So I pivoted, right? And I like traffic engineering. But then because of the economy and the things like that, I ended up doing planning. And then from planning, I ended up doing geotechnical engineering. So I was always open to new experiences. I actually loved geotechnical engineering. That's what I wanted to do. Like, I wanted to be the best geotechnical engineer there is. But then my supervisor at the time, he said, no, you're good with people. And then he put me in positions that were less technical. And I kept begging him. It's like, I want to be a technical guy. No, you're good with people. And it's like, so rather than fight it, I embraced it. And I said, okay, so then I went into managerial positions and leadership. So I think the idea is be curious, ask a lot of questions, but be open-minded and embrace opportunities when they come your way. Recognize them and embrace them.
Really good advice. And I know, like, as a student, I'm sure students today, it's sometimes feels daunting to do those things. But I think the ask a lot of questions to me is the hardest, but the most important thing. Because like I said, right, I was fortunate enough. I had people that I could ask what I thought were dumb questions to, but they would answer them. That set me up for success, right? I learned a lot from them. And I know you asked a lot of people a lot of questions.
You know, I always assume people are going to be kind, right? Like people will surprise you. Not everyone is going to be kind. So it's okay. Dismiss that. It's not you. It's them, right? But like one of my best friends growing up, his uncle was an aeronautical engineer. And he was from Jordan, so he came to visit in Syria. And I hammered him with like a million questions. Like, ooh, aeronautical engineering, that sounds really sexy. I want to do that. It's like, so I asked him a lot of questions that actually sounded very interesting to me for two reasons. It was engineering and it was involved travel. And I've always liked travel. So, but, you know, I ended up doing something else. But I was open to the ideas, all right? So it's just, I tell young people, you don't have to have it all figured out.
No, I love that. So, all right, with that, I'm going to jump us into our lightning round and then we'll wrap up. So lightning round, fast fire questions. First thing that comes to mind, feel free to share. And I'm going to be very clear on this first one, not in New York City, because I know we have many of them here and we're not going to, all of our clients we love. But what's your favorite public transportation system outside of New York City, like somewhere else in the world?
Ooh, Barcelona.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love Barcelona. I was there a couple times. And one of them, I walked like 4 hours and hours for 3-4 days. So, but I did have an opportunity to ride their buses and their metros, and we were very well done.
So Barcelona, to me, is one of my favorite international cities. I love Barcelona. I think it's beautiful. I think the people are great. It's fun. Very cool. All right, great. Next, favorite like dish. Doesn't matter what cuisine, what time of day, but what's your favorite like meal?
I mean, you can't beat pizza.
Yeah. My wife would agree.
It's the perfect food. I mean, we're fortunate. We both came from countries that cultures that have great food.
We have a lot of good food.
You know, and I love all of that. But yeah, I mean, just there's no wrong time to eat a pizza.
Do you have a favorite like Syrian dish? Because I was thinking about, I don't think I've ever had Syrian food. And I do like to try and go out and try new types of food. I don't know if I've ever, is it mostly like Mediterranean or Middle Eastern? What's the cuisine?
Yeah,
like?
I mean, it's a mix of everything. I mean, a lot of vegetables, potatoes, rice, and not as much meat. You know, actually, we have a dish made with okra that I absolutely love. It's okra, onions, garlic, tomatoes, things like that. And they serve it with rice. And the rice, you put these vermicelli noodles in it.
Oh, yes. I love vermicelli noodles.
Yeah. So it's just like, you know, you think about that, like,
I will. So in Indian food, we call it bhindi, but it's okra and just like you described, like onions, tomatoes. I don't know if they put garlic, but like it's very flavorful and it's amazing.
I like the garlic, so I put it in, but I don't know like the exact recipe like my mother made, but my mother would always see me cooking something. It's like, no, don't use onions. That uses garlic. I say, but I want to do it my way.
Yeah.
She had like a very specific way to do the dish, which is the traditional way. And it was always delicious, but I like to experiment with food as well.
You're charting your own path. That's great. Do you have and I'm going to give you a widespread because some people do and some people don't, but a favorite TV show, a favorite movie, or a favorite book?
Yeah, TV show, MASH. It's still probably the best one. And I'm going to massacre the name of the book. I always do because I don't speak French, but Les Miserables.
Oh, okay.
That was my favorite book story. I love the character Jean Valjean and just, I don't know, one of my heroes.
It's iconic, yeah.
Yeah, so that's the book. And I read it when I was very young, but I've seen like a couple of the movies he made about it. So what was the other one?
No, I wish you could have just answered. Yeah. It was TV show, movie, and I guess Les Miserables, and I can't say it either.
Oh, yeah.
Could answer both.
Yeah, movie is It's a Wonderful Life.
Very
that's
nice.
My favorite movie. So I'm Jimmy Stewart. I'm the guy who had his luggage packed and always ready to travel.
All right, last lightning round question. Do you have like a favorite activity or hobby outside of work?
I love skiing. When I'm skiing, I feel like I'm on top of the world, and it's just exhilarating, the views, that feeling that, I mean, for a kid who grew up in Syria, never saw snow until I was, I don't know, like 17. And I learned late in life. I was in my 30s when I learned to ski. I love that. I love being on the golf course because normally I'm with someone I like, and it's just a good, you're with somebody for 4 hours, good quality time, and when you hit the ball nice, that's great. And I love the beach. I have the salt water in my blood growing up on the Mediterranean. So again, being fortunate, I'm standing here talking to you in my office, and I'm overlooking I can see the Verrazano Bridge.
Wow.
So I can see salt water from my window. I mean, it doesn't get better than that.
That is nice. That's great. Well, it's all the time we have for today. Do you have any closing words before I close us out here?
No, I appreciate the opportunity. I always enjoy talking to you, Eric, and now it's like we're talking and recording it. But even if we're recording it, I love talking to you.
No, likewise. And again, I, you know what, it's a lot of the guests are people that I've known and really respect, right? That, I mean, that's where they come from. But I learned so much about them, and I learned so much about you today, and I can see why you're an incredible leader, and I totally understand why Eric picked you for, and Sam Schwartz picked you, and then why you continued on with T.Y. Lynn. Just sounds like you're just very authentic and really care about what you do and the people you work with. And I love that, because I think sometimes, you said it right, most people are kind, but not everyone is. And
yeah, and then that's, you know, that's okay. I mean, you can't expect them all to be kind, and they're not kind, just walk away. I mean, that's, but the other thing, like one of my mantras is, I always tell people this, always do the right thing, regardless of what other people do, right? Don't let their behavior drive your behavior. So it doesn't matter what it is. If somebody wants to be unkind, that's fine. I'm still going to be kind. I just want to interact with you. I have that option.
That's a great quote. I love quotes, and that's a really good one. Oh. Well, Mike, thank you so much for being on. We'll include links to any of the resources from today's shows in the notes. And thanks again for listening, everyone. And look out for our next episode.
This episode is brought to you by Infinite Consulting Corp., your go-to firm for MBE certified project and construction management consulting. Discover how Infinite can help you build a better future at infiniteconsultingcorp.com.